Kultur.
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 Welcome to the podcast Kulturstammtisch. My name is Eric Facon. A podcast with a German name that calls for some explanation. This podcast started its life as a broadcast on SRF, the Swiss National Radio, in 2008. It ran until the beginning of 2019. After a break of a year, the participants and I decided to go on as an independent podcast. Same concept, same people, same name. And that name, Kulturstammtisch, tells you what this podcast is all about. So what is a Kulturstammtisch? A Stammtisch is a special table in a bar, a pub, or a restaurant, a meeting place for those customers who like to sit down with a beer and discuss matters political, social, or cultural with their friends or even passing acquaintances. Think maybe of the Forum in ancient Rome, think 18th century literary salons in France, or think the baobab tree in Western Africa. Think any place where people meet and sit down to talk, think, discuss, and debate. And our theme is cultural. So here we are, a group of 15 people who love talking about culture, culture in the broadest sense that we can think of, anything from things hanging in museums or contained between two book covers to time management and fine wines, anything that defines our lives and our societies. And on to our first theme, Bob Dylan's latest album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. We've discussed this album before, recently, in German. And if you understand both languages, you'll notice that we won't be repeating the same conversation. We've had a month more to absorb the work called Rough and Rowdy Ways. And here are my two guests. First of all, Marcy Goldberg, film historian and cultural critic from Canada, but based in Switzerland. And then we have Hank Schizo, who is a recording artist, musician, guitarist, singer, songwriter from Switzerland and also based in Switzerland. So it's been a long wait for everyone in the Dylan world, for everyone who admires the work of the singer-songwriter. Was it worth the wait, Marcy Goldberg?
Well, I have to admit that I didn't know that Dylan was preparing a new album, so I wasn't sort of impatiently waiting for it. It sort of came as a surprise when he launched Murder Most Foul as a 17-minute video on YouTube. That was kind of how I discovered it. And as to the question of whether I think it's good? Yes, I think it's good. Do I think it's his best work of all time or even his best work of the last 20 years? No, but I think there's a lot to talk about there.
Sure, which we'll do in the following minutes, half hour or so. Hank Schizo, how was it for you? Worth the wait?
Well, the short answer is yes, and I could give you like a 30-minute answer. I adore this album. I think it's one of his strongest works of his whole career, and that's saying something. And I love all of it, and we've had now more time to get into it and like really live with this music, with these songs, and I'm a fan, and I've been waiting for this a long time, and it surprised me. I didn't think that he would come up with something like this.
An album that was released after a career of about 50 years, almost 60 years. Unbelievable. Anyways, so let's start.
Can I ask a question? Just because I just said that I didn't think it was his greatest work of all time, and Hank thinks that it is.
One of his greatest albums. Yeah.
Can you say, like, in one sentence?
Why?
What's so great about? Yeah.
because I think it's something like a culmination of everything that he did without repeating himself. It's like distilled, this enormous career with so many aspects, and he found a way that to the listener seems like almost effortless. To condense this into this album, where I think that every note and every word and every syllable, everything is exactly where it should be. And that's something as someone, I'm making records myself, and I know how difficult it is and how much work this is. And that's why to me this is a true masterpiece.
So we're dealing with 10 new songs, and the first one, as Marcy mentioned before, is a very long track, 17 minutes long. It's a spoken word piece, if I may say so. It's like a personal version or history starting in the 60s with the murder of John F. Kennedy, the American president. That was in November 1963. Well, what did you make of that when you first heard it, Marcy?
Well, when I first heard it, I wanted to listen to it as a song. I wanted to listen to it as a piece of music, sort of the way that you're doing something and you have music in the background and you kind of sort of pay attention to it on a more visceral level without, you know, being too intellectual about it. And I found that it worked very well musically. It's not, it's a bit monotonous. It has a certain kind of repetition, but there's something very nice about that. And, you know, Dylan always experiments with the quality of his voice and the tone of his voice and the way that he sings or doesn't sing. And I liked the sound of it just acoustically. But then as you listen to it, even whether you're trying to pay attention or not, as time goes on, you kind of start noticing that the lyrics are extremely disturbing in a lot of ways. You know, you're being lulled along by this nice rhythm and this melody. And then you hear him saying they mutilated his body and took out his brain and, you know, describing in all gory detail the death of John F. Kennedy. And that's when you realize that the music, this kind of lullaby type music, is kind of a trick to lull you into it. But in fact, Dylan wants to disturb you and he wants to make you think about American history in a different way, and that he's actually kind of angry and upset about things in a way that you might not realize if you only listen to the quality of his voice. One thing I have to admit that kind of bothered me about Murder Most Foul is that we are living in a time where we have a really big problem with conspiracy theories and people who believe in conspiracy theories. And Murder Most Foul lends itself to that mindset, even to the point of people saying, and this is real, I didn't make this up, the song is 17 minutes long. And Q is the 17th letter of the alphabet. And we all know that there's this QAnon movement. So, like, there's people kind of, like, Dylan always provides a lot of material for the Dylanologists to interpret and maybe overinterpret. But in this case, he also provided material that's very fertile for the conspiracists. And even in discussing the murder of JFK in the song, he makes it sound like, you know, this is the rumor that people have been trying to put to rest since 1963, you know, that it was one man, a lone crazy guy wanted to kill Kennedy. And, you know, that there's all these rumors that he was killed by a cabal of people for certain reasons.
Conspiracy and there's a mafia of politicians, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I mean, the expression, the phrase conspiracy theory was invented based on the, you know, all the theories that came out after the shooting of John F. Kennedy. And so I'm not sure whether Dylan has done our culture a favor in terms of going in that direction, but, you know, that's a question that goes off from the, you know, the aspect of the musical artistry.
Well, it's not his job, right? If that's what he wants to say and what he has to say, and I think what he says very, very well, because what he's been doing for decades now is he eliminates the different time frames, and yesterday is now and now is tomorrow, and it's not really important, because that's one of the best things poetry can do. And he's, I think, stream of consciousness or whatever, but he's just, maybe that's stuck in his mind for a long time and he just did it. And I think it's not his job to worry about what he provides crazy people with, you know, to expand on theories, you know.
Well, it does bother me, though, that someone like Dylan, who I consider to be very intelligent and actually an amazing analyst of American culture and history, that he would sort of flirt with the John F. Kennedy conspiracy idea. But it's true. I mean, it's interesting. At the time when Kennedy died, Dylan was just starting out in his career. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was very obsessed with American history of the Depression and of the 19th century. And in his autobiography, mm-hmm. Chronicles, Volume 1 from 2004, he talks about going to the library and reading newspapers, you know, from the 1890s and reading about murders and crimes and deaths and stories. And you know, he was also very obsessed with Woody Guthrie and with the whole kind of Dust Bowl Depression era. So in the 60s, around the time of Kennedy's death, he was singing about those things and using them as material for his songs. And now, in the era of Donald Trump, he has chosen to go back and revisit, you know, the early 1960s. And so that to me is actually super interesting and very symptomatic of Dylan's genius of kind of using history as a way to comment on the present and so on. But yeah, I could have done without the conspiracist aspect because I think we have enough of that.
Okay, let's close that parenthesis. But there is something that I'd like to, think about a bit further. It's this idea of the release date. I mean, he's coming up with something that seems to revert back 50 years or six to 1963. So it's a long period of time. And he seems to connect this with current events. Why would he release something like that now, Hank Schizo?
I mean, that was released without anybody knowing it beforehand on a very dark and cold March night, as far as I remember. And I was surprised at first, and then I thought, oh, there must be an agenda behind this. Because that song at that time, without any prior information, you know, there must be a plan behind this. So then later we learned that some of the musicians said, yeah, they were in the studio in wintertime, and it was like some people knew that something was going on. And I am convinced that this track and the whole album was released ahead of time, ahead of the scheduled release date. I think they wanted to do that later, but obviously
some sort of rush release.
Yeah, I think so. And also, like, as from a market perspective, that was genius, because that fell into a time when nobody was releasing music. And I think at one point, maybe in February or in March, they said, okay, let's go ahead with this. Let's do this now, because this is a time slot we can use. And they did.
Well, it's actually astonishing how relevant a lot of the material was for what was going on exactly around that time, March and April. Dylan has always talked about also racial injustice in the United States, and he's sung about it, and he's also worked on it outside of his music. And then when the George Floyd murder through the police occurred, and the protests were happening around that time, and Dylan almost seemed to be providing the soundtrack for this in a way. But I mean, you could also take earlier albums of his that were already kind of talking about, he's had his finger on that pulse for a very long time. And if you look at what's going on in the United States today, nothing is really new. It's just kind of a more acute and worse and more horrible version of a lot of problems that country has been dealing with for a long time. So the fact that the music seems so apt and so timely speaks to Dylan's very long-standing obsession with these kind of questions and his ability to Hank was saying before that Dylan doesn't have an obligation, to be politically correct or anything like that. But he certainly has always used his talent as a wordsmith to comment on American culture in this sort of oblique way, and sometimes in an almost absurd way. And sometimes there's this kind of Marx Brothers, dadaistic aspect to it. But it was really kind of astonishing how fresh and how timely the album sounded when listening to it in March and April while these things were going on.
But, the history thing, that's been going on for a long time now. And this coming from a man who said...
Sure, since the beginning.
I just read that recently. He was saying at one point that he was born 1941, the year Pearl Harbor was bombed, and he's been living in a world of darkness ever since, which is a provocation in itself, but that's a very strong thing. And if you this time it goes back thousands of years. It's like the whole history of mankind. He sings that in one song. I can see the whole history of the human race. And I think at his age, and with a mind that is so fresh and so alert, it must be awesome to do this with all this knowledge. And I that's to me something that characterizes this album. There's so much information in it, and it's done very lightly. Well, at least that's the impression I get from listening to it. I think it's a lot of hard work.
It's a lot of hard work to understand really what's going on.
Like a light touch,
But there's still a lot to sink your teeth into this material, to understand the quotations, the allusions to lots of cultural events, political events, social events. It's just chock full of stuff like that. Starting with a 17-minute track called Murder Most Foul, naturally Shakespeare. That's where he borrows the title. And that leads us to the first track on the album, which is called I Contain Multitudes. Well, we agreed before that we all contain multitudes, but Bob Dylan seems to contain a bit more than that. it's just also full of people that he continually quotes. There's it's a lot of name dropping also in this first track: Marilyn Monroe, Bob Wills, Buster Keaton, Beatles, Shakespeare, Chopin, Beethoven, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Nat King Cole. I could go on for hours. I mean, it's all there. You can listen to the track and discover it yourself. What did you make of that? Did you understand all of the allusions that he had in there? Or there's a lot of information that you'd have to look up, basically.
Well, I mean, I knew, I would say, almost all of the names. I knew who the people were. I was surprised sometimes at the way that he put them together. Like, there's this line where he talks about Anne Frank, Indiana Jones, and the Rolling Stones. And that seemed to
it
me
rhymes.
Like, it rhymes, but it's sort of, those are the moments where I had to ask myself, like, is this genius or is this ridiculous? You know,
or is, like, it Dada, as you said before?
Or is it both?
Well, or is it kind of this weird doggerel where he's just putting things together because they rhyme without thinking that much about what he's trying to say? On the other hand, Dylan always had the gift of saying these absurd things that people would then think about and find it to be very deep. I mean, it is very deep. You know, Anne Frank, who died in the Holocaust, and Indiana Jones, which is also a story related to Nazis, but it's also adventure. And then you have the Rolling Stones. Like, then you start thinking, like, you know, the same way in the beginning, like when he would say, you know, I don't know, the sun isn't yellow, it's chicken, or the pump don't work because the vandals took the handle. You know, he always had that ability to be sort of very flippant with almost kind of cringy rhymes, but then at the same time that there would be this sort of depth to it. I wondered, though, in terms of him doing this, you know, almost kind of like throwing all of American pop cultural history and musical history into a blender and turning it, as I was listening to it, I wondered how young people would feel, or younger people who maybe aren't as familiar. I mean, I'm also someone who, you know, I'm a cultural studies person, so I also am familiar with some of the names of people who were before my time. You know, like Nat King Cole is more like my grandmother's generation, but I know what it is. And I kind of wondered for a young person who would just sort of come across this on the internet and start listening to this whole litany of names, would they go and Google it and make discoveries, or would they just kind of slide away, or would it not matter, you know, to know all the details of the precision of all, you know, what exactly he means by, you know, putting Anne Frank, Indiana Jones and Mick Jagger, you know, in a convertible together, you know, kind of.
But I did talk to people who are of a different generation, and they really had a bit of trouble with that. They said it was enervating after a while, you know, like even if you work in the cultural field, after the third stanza, you start thinking, well, what's this all about? You know, and I have to look up every second line to understand what this is all about. And maybe, just in case you haven't studied American cultural history, then you're a bit lost as well. It's a lot to ask, and it's a lot of Google work, I think.
Good, good, good. I like that. I like that, because it's in a way it's a provocation in a time when I think I'm 54, and I always been interested in history, and at one point I started to learn that, you know, the, like when Dylan quotes Marcus Aurelius or like Greek philosophy and then goes to the Second World War and to Martin Luther King and Presley and blah blah blah, the whole thing, it's really, if it interests you to connect the dots on a timeline, on a map, that's, I don't think you can get seriously into art, this is a kind of a bold statement, if you don't know where you come from, or where you're, where what nurtures you, where that comes from. I don't think it's possible to get into any kind of depth there. So that's why I like it, because all these references, it made me look up stuff. It made me look up a lot of stuff. And the first time in my life I read about the Muses and whatnot, and it's really, I think it's fantastic, and if this doesn't grab you in any way, and you know, it doesn't have to, then just leave it be. You don't have to listen to it. You can still dance to half of the record.
Yeah, and it's also poetry, isn't it? I mean, and you don't need to understand or explain everything away in poetry, or do you?
No, I mean, the whole intellectuality of it, that's not, to me, that's not in the front. It really isn't. You know, this record can do things with you without you understanding, but it can do so much more. So that's also one of the things that I like.
Well, I think the name-dropping aspect of it is interesting because it fits into Dylan's method in a number of other ways. Because, like, if you think about, I don't know, a song like American Pie by Don McLean, you know, the day the music died, which was the day that Buddy Holly died in a plane crash. And what Don McLean does is he alludes to all these figures without saying them by name. So he'll say, you know, Helter Skelter in the Summer Swelter, or he'll talk about the Jester. And you have to really be very familiar with the music and the culture of that time to get, you know, the allusions. And Dylan is just sitting there, you know, just naming the names and making rhymes out of them. And it's almost like a hip hop method.
Yeah,
actually,
exactly.
The way that hip hop artists do this kind of calling out and mentioning of names, and you reference, you know, a whole other universe by, you know, bringing a name into it. And, you know, in hip hop, they'll do it also with products. You know, they'll be singing, you know, they'll be mentioning Hennessy whiskey, or, you know, Monica Lewinsky, or all, you know, kind of names. And so I think this is something that Dylan has started doing more. He wasn't always such a name dropper the way he's become over his last couple of albums. And I would guess that this is something where he's been sort of influenced by the culture, by hip hop and those musical forms. But if you really look into it, you see that he's doing this name dropping on a whole bunch of levels all at the same time, because he's also musically quoting from all kinds of other work in a way that's also almost similar to the hip hop practice of sampling, except that he's not sampling. He's not taking little recorded bits and putting them in, but he's sort of dropping it in, you know, into the music. There's melodies of, you know, different kinds of songs. He's even quoting some of his own songs. When he sings My Own Version of You, there's the chord changes that a lot of people know from the Portishead song Glory Box, but Portishead actually took it from Isaac Hayes, Ike's Rap Number 2. And so there's a lot of, you can really, you know, how far you want to go down the rabbit hole of following these references, which sort of go back to this giant appreciation, you know, that Dylan practices of his, you know, his whole cultural catalog.
Yeah, which brings us to the folk tradition, because I mean, everything going from 1910 to 1940, that's always been the thing with black and white music, and there's cross reference and everything, and he grew up with this. Not with popular music at that time, but especially if you go to blues and early country and western recordings of the 30s and 40s, they did that all the time. Mm-hmm. And Third Man Records a couple of years back made a thing where they brought old recording techniques back, and they invited new young hip hop acts, and together with like well known people from popular culture, and you see this beautiful connection to it, that like a 22-year-old gangster rapper of Brooklyn, what he does is basically could have been on a record in 1932. It's the same thing, and Dylan's been doing this now for more than two decades. He's been like that whole universe comes together, and I agree with you, Marcy, that he does it with the name dropping now. I find that really enjoyable, because it's like I think he likes it too, and it's like a thing for him to do that. Maybe he has to restrain himself at some point to stop doing that, but it's really I love it.
Well, you know, he had his radio show for a number of years where he was, you know, kind of a DJ, where he his whole musical universe, you know, he could kind of like present it on his own podcast. And sometimes I feel like ever since he did that, it really influenced the music that he's made since then. So that there's times during this record where he talks about, he references Wolfman Jack, who was a famous DJ of the times, you know, 60s, 70s. I remember him sort of vaguely as a child. He was still around. And, you know, Wolfman Jack, play me a song. But actually it's Dylan who's the DJ who's kind of recycling and bringing together, you know, American musical history.
Since we're talking about the music also, we should place that front of stage for a second. I had the feeling that a lot of what we got in the last couple of albums over the past two or three decades almost was like him placing himself in a line of people who further the American folk tradition. This is at least the idea that I got. He's placing himself directly in that line of people who made that music. And with the new one, I don't have that feeling so much, but he drops the names all over the place. Did you get that feeling too, Hank?
No, not really, because what I said in the beginning, that it's like a culmination thing for him. I think that starting with Love and Theft and then going on from there, he experimented with all these styles. The musician said that he's been showing up to sound checks for years with really old songs, like some of them standards, some of them unknown, and they played these songs to get into the mood for this music. And I think that's the method there. This is a pure... I think it's just a love for this music. Whether he grew up with it or not doesn't really matter. But the history, I don't think he places himself in historical context. It's just really what gets out of him musically. Also, I mean, there's stuff on the new record that's not really original. False Prophet, the second song on the record, is an exact copy of the arrangement of Billy the Kid Emerson, one of the early Black Sun Records artists, and it's really a precise recreation of that thing, which is fine with me. And he did that with all the stuff. There's Floater on Love and Theft. There's Beyond the Horizon, which is a Bing Crosby song. It's exactly the same thing. And that aspect of like stealing in quotes, that's the folk tradition. And that's...
Well, the weirdest example for me, though, is I've made up my mind to give myself to you. Yeah. He references the Barcarolle from Offenbach, which is opera. You know, it's sort of light opera. And when that came on, when I listened to the album the first time, I was kind of like, wait a minute, what kind of interlude is this? You know, and Love and Theft. I mean, that was the title of a previous album, right?
It's from 2000.
That was his album that came out on September 11th, 2001. Yeah. It took time for people to pay attention to it because of the whole Twin Towers attack. But it's Love and Theft is also the title of a book by Eric Lott, which is American Cultural Studies, looking at the way that white people appropriated Black musical traditions and Black performance traditions and the whole idea of blackface and cultural appropriation. So by Dylan taking the title of that book and sort of copying it and quoting it sort of only brings that further. But in terms of his connecting with the folk tradition, there's another aspect that I'd like to bring into it, which is that Dylan for a long time has been in this mood of, you know, the end times and the apocalypse. And it's maybe also connected to his conversion to Christianity, which he doesn't talk about that much anymore, but he never, you know, repudiated. But this whole idea of kind of like a second coming, end times, horsemen of the apocalypse, end of the world, and singing about like this mood of impending disaster and doom has been very present in his album since the 2000s. And, you know, talking about like he, you know, the water rising and the flood's going to come and all these disasters that accompany the end of the world, which a lot of them, you know, pestilence and epidemics and things that are happening now when we look around. And I think on that level, he sort of sounds, I mean, he sounds like an Old Testament prophet, but he also sounds like some of the singers of the 20s and 30s, you know, exactly. Like Robert Johnson going to the crossroads and meeting the devil and things like that. And it's interesting to me that in an album that's also very playful and where he's referencing all, you know, Elvis and Anne Frank and all this stuff, that he also has stuck to this kind of disturbing vision of the end times.
That's a really interesting point, because I always thought, looking back at his early albums, you already get the sense of somebody being really old. I mean, he was a young guy when he wrote A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. He was a really young man. He was 23 years old when he wrote one of my favorite tracks, It's All Right, Ma.
Yeah.
I'm Only Sighing, Bleeding, whatever it is. And they're all apocalyptic to the max, really. I mean, for such a young guy to be so negative, really, about the future of the world. It was kind of surprising to me when you think back on it, you know.
But yeah, but mostly, a lot of these songs, when we read Chronicles, we learned what Marcy mentioned, that he went to the libraries, and instead of reading newspapers of the day, he read like newspapers that were 100 years old. And he also says there isn't that much of a difference.
Mm.
Between these two. I mean, there's on German television, for a while they repeated at midnight, they repeated daily news from 30 years back, like every night. And I zapped into this by chance, and I thought, well, oh look, they did the old decor, and they talked about the Middle East and blah, 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 and everything, and I got it. It was 1974 or something, but I thought, that could be, if you change the picture, that could be a news edition of today.
How little has changed. I mean, goes back to another famous, you know, legendary American literary figure, which is Thoreau, right? David Thoreau, who said all news is gossip and, you know, it's not worth paying attention to. But I'd like to also mention, going back to the title, I Contain Multitudes, because it's a reference to Walt Whitman. And I think Whitman is sort of stands on the other side from the folk tradition that's, you know, predicting gloom and doom and only, you know, talking about injustice and so on. Whitman is much more of a sunny figure. And, you know, the line from his poem, Song of Myself, is, do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. And Leaves of Grass was published in 1855. So this is also something from a long time ago, which has a very fresh effect when you look at it today. And Whitman is sort of singing the praises of America, of this new country with new potential, and the potential to liberate people, and the potential to kind of live in a more sensuous way in harmony with nature, and to overthrow certain kinds of shackles. And he was also a very controversial figure in his time. He was sort of, you know, we talk about cancel culture. Whitman was, they tried to cancel him, you know, all the time, because he sang about the body and about sex, and he was homosexual in a time like way before people considered that even like a concept. And I think it's interesting that Dylan has kind of hooked himself now also onto Whitman and onto this idea of, you know, praising nature and trying to look at a more positive vision of human potential and of a vision of justice and equality and joy, which is very untypical for him, actually.
Yeah, but he's done that before, right? I mean, in the 70s, there were these, like, let's go live in the mountains and get fresh trout from the stream songs, you know? So that's, I think the romanticism behind this, which... the American aspect of this romanticism is something of its own. Europeans do that differently. So that whole, like, walking around like a Mormon in the 19th century thing, that's he's done that before.
Back in the 60s, when everybody used to look like hipsters do nowadays, just look-wise.
Exactly.
Did anybody see Scorsese's film about the Rolling Thunder Review, 1975? The interview extract where you get Dylan talking about poetry and about the importance that it has, like the songwriters, and he starts quoting different titles, and amongst them is I Contain Multitudes. I would just like to ask you one thing before we slowly start sliding towards the end. I had the feeling while also listening to it again and trying to assemble those multitudes of allusions and quotes that we mentioned just before, is that I had the feeling that somehow, in a certain way, he was still in a sort of a conversation with Nobel Prize Committee, with his critics, with his fans who were eager to explain everything, and the answer would be, I contain multitudes, and don't try to pigeonhole me. What do you make of that?
Well, he's been saying that since like 1965, you know. I mean, that was always his thing, that he didn't want to be the voice of a generation, and he didn't want people to analyze him too closely, and, you know, don't put your labels on me, whatever you think I am, I'm not, and all these, you know, like lines that he gave in the press conferences. And I think that's always been a huge source of irritation for him, is the way that the media or certain aspect of public life and fame and celebrity has kind of dogged him over time. And I mean, the Nobel Prize thing, I think we talked about about it once in a show that we did in German a couple of years ago. I mean, the it's a bit weird to me. I mean, that you know, they also they gave Barack Obama the Nobel Peace Prize at the beginning of his term, and then after that, he went and like you know sent drone strikes and did all kinds of things to have not deserved it.
The prize, you know.
He had it already. Yeah, and I mean, so sometimes their choices are also a bit like hard to understand. And the idea that they would start giving, you know, popular songwriters the Nobel Prize for Literature is actually fabulous. The why they started with Dylan rather than someone else, I think, is an open question. But it's typical of Dylan that he would be sort of annoyed that they gave him this prize and that he would be, you know, like be so grumpy about it.
Yeah, well, you know, with everything we learned about the Nobel Prize committee and also the foundation is the fortune a guy made by inventing dynamite.
Dynamite,
so,
sure.
So, yeah. So, you know, and
well, that explains a lot about what philanthropy is and what its function is.
Yeah, but, you know, the whole importance of this is it's just a room full of Swedish academics, you know, and you can, I mean... There are plenty of reasons to discuss this or dispute this. So his reaction to his to this, which wasn't a reaction at all, and then 6 months later he delivered a speech like copied from Cliff Notes. So you know, I don't think he pays too much attention to it. Also, saying that, I think he's a very proud man and a very and sometimes vain, you know. Mm. So he really I think he reads more of his critics and what's being said of him. He's fully aware of this, and that's also I think some of the driving force behind some of the lyrics on this album.
Well, I thought it was just, I couldn't stop laughing out loud when I heard the song Mother of Muses, where he asks for the hand of Calliope, who happens to be the muse of eloquence and poetry, and this from the guy who won the Nobel Prize in Literature. I thought it was a magnificent little joke. I would just like to, as a last question, I would like to ask you, Hank, if you don't mind, Marcy, I'll just give the last question to Hank, because it's really a musical question. We've gotten used to every Bob Dylan album over the past decades, starting actually from the beginning, that there are loads of outtakes, different versions of the same songs over and mm-hmm. over again. And sometimes that bootleg series lets you discover that some of the versions that were not released were actually nicer, more incisive than the ones that he released. But do you expect anything like that from this new album, Rough and Rowdy Ways, that will get another collection of outtakes from that?
I don't think we will, because I think everything here is really, I think before they recorded this, a lot of work has gone into this, a lot. Because if you hear the way it's played and it's arranged and also the way it's recorded, I think most of this is live. And these are just great, great performances, and this is a very, very well rehearsed band, and every aspect of recording this was done, it was meticulously done. So I don't think there's too much. I've got a record a fan gave me of one song Dylan recorded for a soundtrack like 15 years ago. It's called Tell Old Bill, and I haven't seen the movie. And what you hear on this on these outtakes are like 12 versions of the song, how they progress to the version that was eventually released. And you hear the whole process of him in the studio. People kept saying for decades he doesn't know a thing about producing and anything. And there's a man in charge, you hear his microphone all the time, and he changes keys and tempos and stuff. And it's really the whole focus is coming along so beautifully. And the second to last version you hear, almost there. And then the last version, the official release, is just a stroke of genius. And I think the same happened here with this record. They knew exactly what they were doing. So I would doubt it. I would love to hear more of it, but I would doubt that there will be any outtakes.
This was the Kulturstammtisch in English for the first time. Our subject was Bob Dylan's newest album called Rough and Rowdy Ways. And my guests in this show were Marcy Goldberg a film historian and cultural critic from Canada who lives in Switzerland, and Hank Schitzel, a recording artist, guitar player, singer-songwriter based in Switzerland and from Switzerland. My name is Eric Facon.